Hello and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined as always by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, the Kavanaugh confirmation. And Richard, to sort of index this for our listeners, we are taping this 2 days into the confirmation process for Brett Kavanaugh, President Trump's nominee to replace Anthony Kennedy on the Supreme Court. And this process thus far has raised a lot of specific issues that we can discuss in a moment. But let me just start you at the macro level. These hearings in just the 2 days that we've had thus far have been repeatedly interrupted by protesters. They've been rancorous. They've been partisan. They've been not especially collegial. It is not exactly a testament to the glories of the American political system. Is, in your judgment, the confirmation process broken? Are we going about this the wrong way?
Well, the answer is yes, I think we are. Part of it has to do with mental states. I think people have now come to the point of view that anybody who's of the other political party is an apocalyptic disaster. If you're trying to figure out where it is that Kavanaugh fits on the spectrum, if I had to make my guess, he is essentially probably the fourth most conservative member of a court of nine, which puts him kind of in the middle. I think that Thomas is more conservative. I think Gorsuch and Alito are. I think that Kavanaugh fits in and is probably a little bit closer to the Chief Justice, even though there's a gap between all of them on the other side. Merrick Garland was, I think, probably closer to the center than he was to the left, probably more conservative than Breyer, Kagan, Ginsburg, and Sotomayor in that order. So, I mean, what are you fighting over is the first question you ask, and it's a little and a lot. You're fighting over very few cases, but the cases are all the hot-button issues. So you hear campaign financing, you hear abortions, right, on things like this, and you hear gun rights. And people assume that anytime somebody gets on who's of the wrong persuasion, they're going to take the most extreme position against them. And what they do is they kind of beat the drums in order to make things look more hysterical than they are. In part, they're trying to score political points for the next election. And in part, what they're trying to do is to raise campaign contributions. This is a completely asymmetrical process. When the Republicans controlled the Senate, they thankfully did not have a hearing in which they tried to besmirch the reputation of an honorable man, Merrick Garland. They just said, look, we have fundamental political disagreements because of these four key issues. We're not going to have a hearing. And the law is perfectly well accepted and understood and agreed to that there is no obligation on the part of the Senate to conduct the hearing any more than there is for the Senate or individual senators to vote yes based upon some fair assessment of the case. And so what you did is you had a divided government and the second half held against the first. The Republicans this time have both keys. And what the Democrats are trying to do is to replicate what happened with Garland, but they can't refuse to hold hearings. So what they're doing is they're throwing everything in the kitchen sink at this particular man in an effort to discredit him in the hopes that they will crack one Republican and get that person to switch over. This tactic is likely to backfire. Or they're trying to create such a trail of disrespect that it will shatter Kavanaugh's confidence and perhaps intimidate him to voting a little bit more liberal than he might have otherwise done if he had not been subject to this kind of abuse. I don't think that will work either. But the whole thing, in fact, is kind of unseemly, and it's clearly it was orchestrated. I mean, Chuck Schumer made up his mind about 2 seconds after the nomination was made, and nothing that could be said or found would change his views. I mean, if you were thinking about this as a neutral search, you'd say, oh, I want to look at certain papers. And oh, by the way, if it turns out I think those things are kind of favorable to Mr. Kavanaugh, I may change my mind and decide to vote for him. Did you or did anybody ever hear a single sentiment of that sort coming out of this hearing? Of course not. The Republicans have no reason to get down in the dirt. They have the control over the system. And so what they're going to do essentially is to try to keep to the high road and to make sure that the distractions and the disruptions don't completely derail the hearings and postpone them in one way or another. The new senator from Arizona, Senator John Kyle, is in fact probably going to be a steadier Republican on this issue than a healthy John McCain. And so I don't think there's anybody there who looks like he's going to be peeled off on the Republican side. And there are probably three or four Democrats who will vote, I think, with the Republicans. So the nomination is likely to go through. And I think the amount of ill will and animosity will continue to rise. The questions are going to be abusive. And as I've said so many times before, and I will say it again, I think there's absolutely nothing to be gained by putting a witness on the stand who is the nominee and say, I'm going to ask you the question of whether or not the president can pardon himself. You know it may come up to you. So answer me now. And the correct answer is the one that has always been given. I can't answer questions about future cases that may come before me as a judge. I can answer that question. I wrote a piece on it in the Wall Street Journal. I think the answer is that the president is a fool to do that, but there's absolutely nothing in the Constitution that blocks it. And indeed, if you looked at the arguments on the other side, they're so overbroad that they're clearly incorrect. So I think what you're going to do is to see this go on all the way through. I see no sign of respite happening. And I regard the thing as a kind of a permanent disgrace for the American economy and for the American public and the American civility system. I have no objections against Democrats saying, we oppose this man. We think he's wrong on principle. We will vote against him. It's the defamation and the hysterics, I think, which bother me.
All right, so let's turn to some of the arguments that we've heard over the past few days, Richard. Democrats have been furious over all the documents they haven't been able to receive from Kavanaugh's past. Now, they have about 300 opinions from Kavanaugh's time as a judge, in addition to a bunch of material from his work on the Clinton investigation. But they what they want are documents from his time as associate White House counsel and then White House staff secretary in the George W. Bush administration. Are those kinds of documents in any way essential to understanding whether Kavanaugh is a qualified judge, or is this kind of much ado about nothing?
Well, it certainly has nothing whatsoever to do with his intellectual abilities and his analytical prowess. He's a very strong judge, and before he was nominated for the Supreme Court, was always thought to be in a very small elite of truly great appellate court judges in the United States, respected pretty much by everybody on both sides. In fact, when Heather Gerken, the dean of the Yale Law School, had the temerity to say he was a distinguished nominee, the whole world fell in upon her, not because she was saying something that was wrong, but because the people at Yale who did not want to see him confirmed essentially mounted a very strong attack. What they're trying to do is not to find out about his judicial philosophy. They don't care about that. They don't care about anything. What they hope to do is to find something that looks like dirt. And right now, the most recent allegation is that somehow or other he was involved in certain of the hearings associated with the whole question of detainee rights with respect to various kinds of incarceration. What sort of testimony can they give and what not? And I actually wrote about some of those cases, including Hannity, and took the position that essentially you could not short circuit the due process requirements by creating a special set of administrative tribunals that didn't have any of the safeguards. So this is not an argument to say that I'm on the other side. Kavanaugh's position on most of this is a lot of paper went through his hands, but he wasn't doing it. And the Democrats hope to catch him in something. And I could say it's even a little bit worse than that in some sense. They hope that they can make a charge and that the charge will stick before the refutation could come forward. And that's always a risk in these kinds of cases. The maxim in defamation is that lies travel more rapidly than truths. And so they hope to get the first mover advantage. If it's true, so much the better. If it's not true, I'm not so sure how upset they would be, because this is clearly a no holds barred game. And the question about how much do you get? Well, with all previous nominees, executive privilege was constantly claimed with respect to delicate personnel stuff. The Republicans never asked for information about the role of Elena Kagan when she was Solicitor General, even though she was involved in cases that would soon come before the Supreme Court, some of which she recused herself from, some like the healthcare cases not, even though the strategy was planned when she was in office. They didn't do that. And I think that they were right not to do that, because there's a lot of other stuff in there about a lot of other people, which if it came out in this context would look terrible. And I also think that it's kind of odd to say we need to have all of this stuff to make up our minds when our minds are completely made up. And under those circumstances, I think that, you know, Grassley was right to hold his ground. And I think, in effect, the Democrats will never let go of the issue, but they can't compel the production. That's because they don't run the particular show. It's very clear if they ran this particular nomination hearing and it was a Trump nominee, he would never get a hearing. Now, just as happened with respect to Garland. Only it would be more vehement and probably more vicious. McConnell was something of a gentleman when he said no, and he didn't engage in character assassination, which I think we all want to be thankful for.
You mentioned the issues around recusal that attached to Justice Kagan. There was a big push in the questioning today about whether Kavanaugh would recuse himself in cases that directly involved criminal or civil liability for President Trump. Whether he'd do that on grounds of it being a conflict of interest. This came from Senator Blumenthal from Connecticut.
I regard that as a complete absurdity. I mean, he did make some statements in connection with this issue back in 1998, but that was in connection with Clinton. And, you know, he was cautious about impeachment. And that, I think, showed the sense that he actually could see both sides of an argument because his political adversary was on the other side. But if you start putting this kind of thing forward, then you could say, well, you know, I think you want to recuse yourself from any case or issue on which you took on a position when you were on the appellate courts. Or you could say to Thurgood Marshall, rumor has it that you argued Brown v. Board of Education and you're a strong defender of the civil rights movement. We think, given that predisposition, what happens is we will not let you vote on any civil rights cases when you sit on the United States Supreme Court. There is no more dangerous precedent than trying to carve out sort of whole areas from competence because of somebody's past record. The correct test is if you've been involved with a particular client, you don't hear cases involving that client for a period of about 3 years, after which that client is just like anybody else and you do it. And if you were involved in the argument or in the preparation of any individual case that comes to the Supreme Court, you recuse yourself from that. And remember, that could take place years later. So suppose it turns out that you're involved in a case in 2012, if you were a potential nominee, and it doesn't get to the Supreme Court until 2020, the fact that 8 years have passed and you may be 3 years on the court doesn't make the slightest bit of difference. You have to recuse yourself. It's interesting to note, by the way, at the Supreme Court, there are no constraints on who recuses themselves from what. It's left to the discretion of the judge. Lower court judges are bound by a more complete set of rules. So I think that is, again, is just another one of these very bad suggestions. Let me give you another illustration to show how dangerous this is. You get somebody like Sessions, and suppose what happened is when he was nominated for that position, without any sign of conflict, somebody said, well, you were in the Trump administration. We want you to recuse yourself by virtue of that association from anything to do with the Russia investigation. A mistake. You don't want to create situations where you have a divided authority. And indeed, my view was that the moment it turned out that he felt that he had to withdraw in some sense because of the conflict of interest associated with the Russia investigation, he effectively compromised himself as an attorney general and created a lot of the antipathy that exists today. So if you're in on one of these things, you're all in. A constitution has structural provisions which cannot be waived by anybody or by everybody in concert. And one of them is when you sit on the court and you exercise the judicial power, you cannot say, I exercise the judicial power except in class of cases X, whether it deals with antitrust or with civil rights or employment discrimination or anything else.
Let me get you to react to something that was said early in the confirmation process by Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey. Booker, there was a discussion about originalism, and he sort of nodded to the greatness of the founding fathers, but then responded to his colleagues' arguments for originalism by saying, well, the founders were flawed too, and he invoked them referring to Indians as savages, not carving out rights for women. He made a sort of customary reference to the Three-Fifths Clause and the treatment of African Americans. So this is not a terribly sophisticated argument. It's the kind of thing that you might hear from an undergraduate, but this is coming out of the mouth of a U.S. senator and a potential presidential candidate, Richard. So what's the response to those who claim that there were such inherent flaws at the founding that we shouldn't feel too bound by the text of the Constitution that they wrote?
I think it's a case of incautious and wild overgeneralization. If you take some of the particular proceedings that you're talking about, the Fugitive Slave Act, the Three-Fifths Provision, and so forth, there was a civil war, and all of those things were removed from the Constitution. But if you then start looking to other causes which talk about the extent of the judicial power, the protection of the First Amendment, what you do is you see a rather consistent and compelling document. And so having excised the stuff that doesn't matter, then you try to get right the rest of the stuff. Mind you, this is not an argument about originalism or any mode of textual interpretation. It's an argument which says we just don't have to respect the entire document at all. And you could be a person who believes in the living constitution, and you can say, I don't care what's written in this particular text. I don't care how it's been construed. This is what I would like to do. And I don't think any judge should regard themselves as in a position to be able to do that. And so why you would want to say, for example, to give you an illustration, oh, we have this funny thing known as the Fourth Amendment, which deals with unreasonable searches and seizures. This was passed by a Congress which had the Fifth Rule. You know what? Let's ignore the kinds of protections that it provides and allow police to do any kind of search they want the moment somebody gets on a public highway. I can't conceive of why this turns out to be a decent argument. If they want to say that the people who put this Constitution together were racist, the answer is some of them were, some of them weren't. But then you get the following kind of very awkward situation. One of the things you could have done was not to have a United States and to basically say that the Mason-Dixon line separated two separate nations. You have the slave states in the South, and they form a confederacy as of 1787, and you get the states in the North. That's what the alternative is going to be, because one of the very tragic things about slavery is that its defenders back in 1789 were not exactly shy about what they regarded as the inevitable necessity of the slave-type relationship. Well, would you rather have two countries or one country? The framers essentially thought better to deal with one. And it's interesting to note the way in which James Madison actually tried to deal with this issue. Madison was no dummy, to put it mildly. And so when it came to the question of how you defended the three-fifths rule, he did not speak. What he did is he invoked a literary convention, and he announced that there was one of my southern brethren who will explain to you why this position makes perfectly good sense. Everybody understood it was a terrible hot-button issue at the time, and I think, you know, the Civil War erased it, and now when you're dealing with the Constitution, there is a huge question of what we mean by originalism, what we mean by textualism, and so forth. On that, I actually think that what happens with somebody like Kavanaugh is he's been through enough of these cases that he knows that no single bullet is going to be able to solve this problem. You can't ignore text. But you have to worry about implied exceptions. You have to worry about structural inferences of one sort or another. You have to worry about historical evolution. You have to worry about contemporary understandings. You have to worry about whether or not something's been around so long that it becomes part of the prescriptive constitution. And if you understand all of that stuff and you're aware of the trade-offs, that's a good sign. Because it means that somebody who sees all the nuances is much less likely to go off the rails in some way than somebody who thinks that there's a single buzzsaw that answers this problem. I wish it were the other way around. And if it were, being a justice would be a lot easier. But I teach constitutional law, including this week. And just to give one example, when you came to the famous question as to whether or not Harry Truman, an honorable man, could seize the steel mills and tell the executives that they have to run it to keep the Korean War effort going. You had six different very thoughtful opinions in the United States Supreme Court on that particular question. And what was so interesting about the discussion is that they can't all be right because they were, in fact, in some sense, deeply inconsistent with different implications. But you never got the sense in reading any of them that they were doing anything other than their level best to see their way through a very difficult set of problems in which you're not quite sure of the scope of the commander-in-chief power, you're not quite sure of the scope of the executive power, the take-care clause, you're not quite sure of the relationship of Article 2 to Article 1 and so forth. When cases get to the Supreme Court, the slot machine theory of justice does not work. And what you have to do is to have some people who have a sensitivity and awareness to this. Sitting on an appellate court that does a lot of constitutional and a lot of administrative law makes you sensitive to those issues. And so if you actually try to figure out how Kavanaugh has behaved, he has always been somebody who's been nuanced. I'm just going to mention one other point, which is one of the great issues that we have today, under which I think the conservatives and the Trump administration do much better than the liberals, is the question of how much procedural due process you have to give to somebody before you could strip them of a patent or strip them of their ability to practice, say, before the securities bar, or basically denounce them for the way in which they sell cakes and so forth, or to subject them to financial penalties through the Consumer Fraud Protection Bureau. And it's the Democrats in each and every one of these cases that are willing to live with truncated procedures by biased judges to run people through the mill. And it was interesting to note that both with respect to the securities case and with respect to the patent case, the Trump administration basically backed off what it was that the Supreme Court said that they can do. So it's just very difficult when you're trying to work these things through to even know today which party is the party in favor of civil liberties and which one is not. On this whole question of procedural due process, unconstitutional conditions, can you say to somebody you can't become a judge unless you swear a loyalty oath or something like that? Things have completely flipped over. It's the Democrats who become highly authoritarian and the Republicans who become small government proceduralists. And, you know, that's something to which I think many of the people who are worried about the illiberal democracy in the United States should understand that the peril that we have on that issue comes in many cases as much, if not more, from the left than it does from the right.
The final question that I'll put to you, to what extent do you think that change in process, the now more partisan, more contentious nature of the Supreme Court nominations, has changed or will change the quality of the justices themselves? In other words, is it harder to get first-rate thinkers on the bench in this environment than it may have been in the past?
Well, I mean, judging from the last two nominees, both of whom are extremely strong candidates in terms of their intellectual and their practical credentials, I think the answer is no. I mean, if you're somebody who's a sitting judge, you know where Valhalla is located, and it's not in Denver, Colorado. It's back in the Supreme Court building. So I think what happens is that people will endure a huge amount of abuse if they think that they could get a position which is one of a great importance to the nation and one which is a great complement to their professional abilities. And I think it will happen on both sides. There's only one candidate, I think, who simply did not know how to play the game when he got there, and that was Robert Bork. He did not cut his hair. He did not know the way in which he was supposed to respond to softball questions. Everything he did was essentially made it worse for him. But there's nothing about what either Gorsuch did or what Kavanaugh has done, which has given rise to this kind of anxiety. I think that the Roberts and the Alito hearings, though contentious, not nearly as much as this one, also show no signs of any kind of error. Certainly with respect, if you go back a little bit further to Ginsburg, and to Breyer, those were basically cakewalks. And even the Kagan and the Sotomayor nominations, although the differences were great, the Republicans were by and large much more civil about their opposition than the Democrats have been today.
All right. You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.